Shigu Segan Mo Shujo Muhen Segan Do Mono Mujen Segan Dan Homo Muryo Gaku Butsudo Mujo Seiganjo. So these are the four vows of the Bodhisattva in Mahayana Buddhism. So not only in Zen, but in many strands of Buddhism. You'd find them in Tibetan Buddhism as well. And I'll read them out, and then I want to talk about them. So, beings innumerable, I vow to save them all. Desires inexhaustible, I vow to overcome them. Dharma gates countless, I vow to pass through them. Buddha way supreme, I vow to follow it. So that's one translation. There's different ways they can be translated, and I will say a few words as we go through about some things about those translations which aren't, in my mind, don't quite capture what it's about. And the other thing I wanted to say is that those of you who have listened to some of the Bristol Zen Dojo broadcasts over the last year will know that I spoke for a period of time, almost a year ago, about the Sandokai, the harmonizing of the relative and the absolute, a Chinese Zen poem. And always in Buddhism in generally, but particularly in Zen, there is the importance placed on harmonizing both a relative perspective and an absolute perspective on practice, on life, on reality, and living from both of those positions rather than running from one into the other and dwelling only in one of the two. I wanted to say that because as I speak about the four vows, I want to try to speak both from relative positions and from absolute positions, and so you can get some sense of the different meaning of the vows from those two perspectives. So it's a recurring theme in Zen teaching, moving from the relative to the absolute and the absolute to the relative, and living in both. And the Genja Koan of Dogen is perhaps one of the most beautiful and eloquent expressions of that teaching. So the first thing to say is, and well, this is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about the relative and the absolute. You'll notice that the four vows are phrased, all four of them are phrased in such a way as to emphasize the impossibleness of fulfilling them from a relative point of view. Beings innumerable, I vow to save them all. Desires inexhaustible, I vow to overcome them. So there is already in the phrasing of these vows a paradox. We are vowing to do something that, from a relative perspective, is impossible. And from the absolute perspective, in a certain sense, they are always already achieved in the letting go. And we live with both of these positions in Zen. So, looking at each of these in turn, beings innumerable, I vow to save them all. And beings are sentient beings, so it's any living being from a Buddhist point of view. And sometimes you'll find that Dogen speaks as of rocks and trees also as being sentient beings which we vow to save. And so it's not only individual beings, but to use a Western expression, ecosystems too, that we are. We are basically vowing to save, I suppose, existence from suffering. Individuals, ecosystems, the whole of reality, to save all of them from suffering. And this is perhaps the most, I suppose, canonical of the Bodhisattva vows, because it famously is what the Buddha effectively agreed to do from a legendary point of view. Because the story is that the Buddha was awakened and effectively was able to step out of the suffering which they experienced. But as they did so, were asked by previous Buddhas who had had a similar experience to step back into the world and teach, share their wisdom with others, so that the stepping beyond suffering was not something which was an individual experience, but was shared with all. So from a relative point of view, the Bodhisattva vow is thinking about how to help others to reduce suffering. And I, in the past, I like to quote, because I asked a question about that very early in my practice to my first teacher, Nancy Amphu, who founded the Bristol Dojo together with her partner, Jean. And when I asked her that question, I actually said, I said, how do you help people who are suffering? For example, my mother, was what I said at the time. And she said, leave them alone. Well, I was going to say leave them alone, but it's difficult to leave your mother alone, is what she said. So her first response to how do you help people who are suffering was leave them alone. And the reason is because so often we are too eager to help from the ego. So this isn't true of everyone. I can, you know, there's people, perhaps even past presidents of the United States, who maybe are not so eager to help. But many of us have a desire to help others. And that desire is often bound up in our ego. And so part of the Bodhisattva vow, from a Zen point of view, is letting go of that desperation to help, to be better, to do good in the world. So don't be too busy and desperate to help, because true true support of others comes from a place deeper than our personal opinions. I think that's the best way of saying it. So my wife Ilse, who you might have heard in the background last night talking with Mira, she said one of her expressions was that unrequested advice is one of the most overrated of offerings. And she wasn't slagging me off at the time, I just hastened to add. but yeah, unrequested. So we are very keen to help, and partly that help comes from a position of, sometimes it comes from a position of desperately wanting to be good, sometimes it comes from a position almost of wanting to assert our authority over others. There's many ways in which it comes. And the one of the things about, from a deep Zen perspective, is that we must let go of the ego wanting to help, to be able to truly help others. And so this, in the end, it comes down to being open and aware to the needs of the others. Needs of the others in the broadest sense, not just the people right in front of us. The people right in front of us, yes, particularly those who we are connected with relationship to, a relationship in the broadest sense of the word. Yes, Don't be desperate to help them, but be open to provide support in the ways that are appropriate to their needs. So also I'd like to just quote our other founder, Jean Babi. He used to use the expression demon of good. He said that people don't cause suffering. We individually don't cause suffering because we want to be bad, usually. We usually cause suffering because we want to be good, but we are overly attached to our idea of what being good is. So we have a fixed idea which we force upon the world of how the world should be. And that act of forcing it upon the world causes suffering for ourselves and for others and for humanity and for the whole of the planet and for existence. And so part of the Zen practice is to see this desire to help arise and go beyond it. But just to be clear, this does not mean that we don't act. This is something that, again, Dogen speaks of very eloquently in the Genja Koan. We let go of these things, and nonetheless, we do act from our relative place, from our personal karma. We manifest in the world in response to the situation in which we find ourselves. We manifest something which may or may not cause positive ripples, but we let go after that manifestation. So that's from the relative point of view. It's good to do good in the world, but it's also appropriate to let go of the desperate attachment to do good, the desperate attachment to do the right thing, the belief that we know what is best. All of these things, we let go. And by letting go of these things, then we can, to quote Master Deshimaru, naturally, unconsciously, and automatically find appropriate action in the moment in response to the situation. This will happen more or less, sometimes more, sometimes less, sometimes mistake, sometimes not mistake. And mistake, simply observe and let go once again. Because we're all acting from a relative place, we're acting from our personal karma. And none of us are perfect. None of us will ever, no matter how much we let go of our ego, manifest perfectly in the world. And don't give ourselves a hard time about that. So that's the relative perspective on helping others, on saving all beings. But there is an absolute perspective as well. And the absolute perspective is that, in the end, from a Buddhist perspective, suffering is liberated from within the space between thought, in the space where self does not manifest, in the space where ego is not dominant. And so we are always already free from suffering in our Buddha nature, in the emptiness where the thoughts and the discrimination and the emotions are not what is most important. So we always suffer from a relative point of view, but from an absolute point of view, we are always already beyond suffering. And from a Zen point of view, it's living both of these realities, realizing in the sense of manifesting in the world both of these realities. And so from that point of view, from the absolute perspective, then to save all beings is to create environments, space in the relative world where this realization can come to others. So from a naive point of view, a superficial point of view, that means creating and encouraging practice, creating and encouraging teaching, all these things, with the proviso of exactly what I said earlier on, that it's very easy to allow one's ego to get caught up in the game of absolutely trying to save everyone from suffering by forcing Buddhism down their throats, which isn't a good thing. So it's finding the balance. And I'll quote Guy here, who will be speaking this afternoon. A quote from Guy is, "Bear witness to the simplicity which is the posture itself, is in itself helping others find their way to an absolute perspective." I think the other thing to say about it is that from a relative point of view, we can sometimes become overwhelmed. Beings innumerable, I save them all. I know that at times in my life, I have felt, not because of those words, and in some ways, by seeing the impossibility of those words, it's helpful, but by having that feeling that I must help and not realizing the impossibleness of the situation, if we think that we heroically can save the world, save the planet, or even save one other person, it's a very egoic idea. And if we get caught up in that idea, then we ourselves can suffer, because no matter what we do in the relative world, it will always be inadequate in response to this feeling which many of us feel. So I've got something written down here. I don't know when I wrote this, but it's from Eno, who was one of the early transmission of the Zen lineage. And we cannot do the whole of this by ourselves. Don't think we can. It's just pointless to think that we can do this all by ourselves. Each being has its own form of liberation. They have their own troubles, but also their own fundamental nature of awakening, which can lead them to freedom. And so the Bodhisattva vow arises naturally in us through practice. And we taste what is shared with all beings when we let go of our personal ego, our personal thoughts. The space between and behind our thoughts and emotions is shared with all beings, with all of humanity, with all creatures, rocks, stones, plants, everything, at a certain fundamental level, beyond thought. And we are each trapped by our own karma in different ways. And the Bodhisattva vow is simply to make space to allow others to find their way out of those traps. So that's the first of them. That's probably the one I'm going to talk most about, because in many ways that's the most important of those. And they all link together. That's the other thing to say about the Bodhisattva vows. They all link together. The second one, desires inexhaustible, I vow to overcome them. And I don't like the word desires. That's the first thing I'll say in this translation, because it doesn't exactly capture what the fundamental word is. So in Japanese it's bonno, and in Sanskrit it's klesha. And those of you, I know there's a few of you I notice online who know a little bit about yoga philosophy. It's something that appears in the Yoga Sutras, the word klesha, something that appears in both Buddhism and in yoga, the word klesha. And the way it's often translated by scholars is afflictions. But even that isn't a very good translation. A better way of thinking about the klesha is the fundamental drives of life. What makes us a living being? I was going to say what makes us human, and partly it is what makes us human, but these klesha exist in all beings. And the klesha are the drives in life which push us to act in existence. The fact that we like some things, we don't like some things, we want to escape from some things, we're frightened of some things, we love some things, we are desperate for some things, we want to flee from some things. All these are the klesha. They're the things which push us around in life. And they are very important, because it is the klesha which make you eat. It is the klesha which make you get out of the way of a bus which is rushing towards you. So that's why it's kind of wrong to say that they are desires. It's also wrong to say that they are defects and afflictions. They are what in the relative world keeps us alive and pushes us forward. And so from a Buddhist point of view, we are not trying to completely cut these so they are non-existent. At least not in the life that we lead, because they are part of life. But what we endeavor to do is to shine a light on them so they are no longer unconscious. They are enlightened to us. They are no longer unconscious. And so, as a result, we are no longer tangled up in them. We are not puppets on the string of our desires, of our fears, of our ignorance, of our hatred, of our avoidance. So we are no longer puppets of these things. And at times they will. The reality is that in the relative world, at times they will dominate us. And the Zen practice is simply to observe, to notice, to acknowledge and accept, and to let go of the many times when they arise, either in small ways or in big ways, in the lives that we lead. And so that's why they are inexhaustible. They never go away. To live is to experience these things. They are just a natural part of life. But nonetheless, I vow to overcome them, in the sense of I vow to go beyond them. I vow to step beyond them. I vow to inhabit the space of awareness where they are simply waves on the surface of a deep lake, where in the depths of the lake there is stillness. So that's the second of the four vows. The third vow: Dharma gates countless, I vow to pass through them. So again, there's a relative and an absolute perspective to this. The relative perspective, the Dharma gates, means the teachings of Buddhism and Zen. So the Dharma gates I vow to pass through them means that I vow to engage with the teachings of the Buddha and those that came after them, and being open to those teachings as a guide to living. So in other words, understanding those teachings on a relative level and allowing those teachings to help shape the life that we lead. And when we do this, if we read sutras, that kind of thing, if we study, then this is as an act of service for the other vows rather than an end in itself. So we do not engage with the teachings, engage with study, engage as something to reinforce our ego or give us something more that other people don't have, or to achieve something. Rather, this is as an act of service, something that is an act of service to all of humanity, all of existence, and to the other vows. And so it means I would say that some people choose to study, and that's a good thing. But if that's not something that, if you're not into reading old Buddhist texts, reading Dogen, who's not that easy to study, that's fine too. Basically, embodying a simple teaching is enough. In many ways, it's actually better than knowing lots of Buddhist philosophy and turning it into an intellectual word game. What Dogen and others called getting tangled in the vines. So that's what the Dharma gates is. It means understanding the teachings of the Buddha and those that came after, and embodying those teachings in one's life from the relative point of view. But at the deeper level, all of existence is the Dharma. This very moment is the Dharma. And so a Dharma gate is each moment of the existence into which we are thrown? And can we pass through that Dharma gate with awareness, with a letting go of ego, and allow action appropriate to that moment to arise within us as we step through? So that's the more absolute perspective. Can we let go into the moment and move into the next Dharma gate? And that's why the Dharma gates are countless, because we live countless moments of life, and every moment is an opportunity to practice, not in some heroic kind of egoic way, but it's an opportunity to be aware and pass, and to live each moment wholeheartedly, to use Master Dogen's expression, to live wholeheartedly each moment. And wholeheartedly does not mean denying pain. It just means wholeheartedly being with what we must live in the moment as we pass through. And then finally, the Buddha Way Supreme, I vow to follow it. And from a Zen point of view, inevitably, following the Buddha Way means regular practice of Zazen, and also practice of the awareness that arises from Zazen in the everyday lives that we lead, whether it's in our workplace, whether it's with our partner, whether it's with our housemates, whether it's with our family, whether it's with the people that we interact with, whether it's when we're alone walking. All these are an opportunity to practice, again, not in some heroic way, but simply being present to what we do and to live the reality in which we live. Shigo Segan Mo Om Shujo Muhen Segan Do Bono Mujen Segan Dan Homo Muryo Segan Gaku Butsudo Mujo Segan.